Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koch is my name, Rodney McCune and Ozan Ibrahim are my co-hosts, and we are delighted this week to welcome David Imber from Melbourne, Australia, who, well, had a front seat to history in the making in that country over the weekend. David, welcome. Thank you so much for joining. Take us through the headlines of what on earth happened in Australia on Saturday night.
Well, thank you, Adam. Thank you all for being here. It was a fantastic election, really, because it was quite unexpected and quite surprising. To just go back a few months, Labor was on the ropes. The governing party in Australia was on the ropes last year. But they came out very strongly at the start of the year. The Prime Minister brought in some strong new policies around Medicare, had a spring in his step, and, you know, really tried to define Medicare as a cost of living issue, universal healthcare system, and really sort of started to look a lot more strong and electable. The coalition had a slower start to the year, didn't put out many policies, but they were still really tipped to do better. And they had a lot of confidence going into Saturday's election. The opposition leader, Peter Dutton, said, "We can win." And, you know, there was real confidence in the Liberal Party that, you know, if they wouldn't win, they'd come close. You know, most polls were saying it was close. Labor would win, you know, minority government at best. But really what we saw was an election where the campaign made a significant difference. And the coalition made significant errors throughout the campaign, slow to policy, you know, candidate selection. Issues just didn't flow their way. Tariffs interrupted them. The death of the Pope interrupted momentum. And everything really just led to a situation where Labor hasn't just won. Labor has won with a substantially increased majority, and the opposition leader has lost his own seat. So we've seen quite a change from what we expected late last year. And certainly, you know, the polls weren't completely wrong. I think people just didn't trust the polls after a big election in 2019 where Labor was supposed to win, or the polls were saying they would win and they didn't. But we did see the polls close towards Labor, move strongly towards Labor, especially with young people throughout the campaign. And I think that's what's happened.
So take us through the historic victory for Anthony Albanese, the incumbent and the Prime Minister, the Labor Prime Minister, because as I understand it, this is, in terms of the number of seats they have in Parliament, this is the best they have had in decades. He's obviously the second Prime Minister to have won back-to-back elections because of the revolving door of leaders that we've seen in Australia. But what made Albo, as he's known in Australia, what made him so appealing, do you think, in picking up so many of these seats that really a lot of the pundits and a lot of the polls had put in doubt and potentially ones that they probably wouldn't have picked up if they picked up any at all? I mean, how did he pull off this incredible victory for the Labor Party?
It really is quite historic. Traditionally, second terms in Australia usually result in the ruling party going backwards in numbers. Parties rarely lose on a second election, often lose after the third and almost never have a fourth term, but they usually get returned with a reduced majority in the second term. Labor's reversed that and gone up significantly. And obviously this is only the third time a leader of a party's lost their seat. The last leader to lose their seat was John Howard in 2007, the Prime Minister who lost seat of Bennelong. Bennelong had a 10% swig on briberies in this election. It's probably come back on postals, I should just say, for this will go out when more postals have come in. But really, everything went right for Labor and everything appeared to go wrong for the coalition. And that's also rare. You know, the government really was facing what most incumbent governments was facing going into this election. Cost of living crisis. People were grumpy. People were miserable. And traditionally, those people blame the government. So it was right for the opposition to focus on cost of living. The problem was the opposition didn't have the policies and the trust to win on cost of living. And so what I think really happened was the coalition took a lot of comfort in the fact there was a referendum on the voice to Parliament for Indigenous people that was lost by Labor in 2023. And they really took a lot of faith that those that loss, which included Labor voters, essentially meant the government had lost faith with people, forgetting that it is always possible for political parties to turn themselves around. And I think what we really saw is that the Labor Party turned itself around. They were very diligent in focusing about cost of living. They were very focused on wages. Medicare is really popular. It's the strongest brand strength that Labor has. And they just kept chipping away at, basics. We're doing something, we're making an effort, energy bill relief. There was, more of that over last year. They just were doing everything right incrementally. And then they really came out of the blocks early in the year, were very disciplined, very on message. The Prime Minister, Albo was not always on message. He was a bit loquacious, but he got very tight and very focused. And I think the opposition really believed that they didn't have to do much more than harvest this, harvest this discontent, and that the votes would come. And it just increasingly looked, over February, March, and April, there were key moments where it just didn't look like the opposition had it all together. They wanted to fight culture wars. In January, Peter Dutton gave a shadow minister who was very influential in The Voice, Jacinta Namajira-Price. He gave her a new title of the Shadow Minister for the Department of Government Efficiency, which obviously sounds very much like the DOGE in US. And, that was sort of really discordant when, we just were starting to see, the impacts of Trump governing. It was just about to be inaugurated then. But fast forward a few months, in the middle of this campaign, we have the US making a decision on tariffs, which is against Australia's interests, but Australia was, received the lowest level of tariffs. That was seen as, positive in Australia. The Prime Minister was, looked very sober and very disciplined. There were just so many examples where, there was just not the right discipline, not the right messaging, not the right policies. A big mistake leading in to the campaign was really the election was supposed to be in April. Experts thought it would be in April, but there was a cyclone in Queensland, which is Peter Dutton's home state. Labor made a big show of not calling the election while that cyclone was on, and had, the Prime Minister based up there, the Treasurer in Queensland in gumboots and, football shorts, working with people. Peter Dutton went to a fundraiser in Sydney after he was briefed, then sort of disappeared offline for a few days. That was not a good look, and Labor did weaponize sort of memories of Scott Morrison going to Hawaii during fires. And then just one more thing, a sort of early bit of the campaign, Labor had to hold a budget, and that was going to be seen to be very bad for Labor. But Labor announced tax cuts. The Liberals said they would oppose tax cuts and instead had a 25-cent reduction in petrol excise as their policy. They said they opposed tax cuts on the basis that it was unaffordable. Then 2 weeks into the campaign, suddenly announced a tax benefit in the next financial year. So they just, their brand strength is small government tax cuts, and they ran away from it and then ran to it. They just weren't showing the best of the Liberal Party's been formidable in Australia, won more elections in the last 50 years than than Labor has, but they just did not have the discipline, did not run to their brand strengths, and Labor kind of did everything right.
Ozan, interested in your views. Obviously, you used to work for a Labor Party minister back in your home state of Victoria, and have been quite active, and I'm sure have been speaking to a lot of your friends and ex-colleagues over the weekend. What happened from a base perspective? Because the Australian Labor Party has always associated itself with the working class and trade unions, etc. I mean, the opposition lost its the wealthiest suburbs and the wealthiest electorates where traditionally it has won. It lost the outer suburbs, which where they thought that they would win. Does this indicate a shift of voter dynamics in terms of how they identify themselves with the major political parties in Australia?
It's a great question, Adam, and something that I've been not only talking to colleagues and former colleagues about and friends, but also have been given it quite a bit of thought. I think you need to take a bit of a look at what David was talking about in terms of the context and the backdrop of the election. I think many of us would like to see a scenario where, a lot more of that data, a lot more of those insights come out. But I think there were many factors at play. Obviously, Trump, and David very well summarized, I think, Peter Dutton's problems and his, I guess, lack of defining himself, and, you know, spending the last 2 or 3 years not doing a great deal in terms of defining the policies and what the coalition stand for, and then having to spend the campaign period of 5 weeks trying to do that. Of course, that's not enough time. So I think a part of me says, I think there seems to be a shift, particularly when you look at some of those out of Victorian electorates, suburban electorates in Victoria. You know, you look at your Casey, your Latrobe, and, you know, you look at other New South Wales electorates, Hughes comes to mind. These are electorates where the previous very successful Conservative Prime Minister, John Howard, took these and really cemented the Liberal Party's strength in those suburbs. And he used the term the battlers. He was standing up for the battlers. So the aspirational class, a lot of tradies, a lot of people doing their own businesses, these sorts of demographics. And you saw a significant swing in that area, in all of those types of areas. In fact, I think the seat of Hughes is the first time that Labor may win it since the John Howard days, which is very interesting. And then, of course, when you look at the Labor heartland, which are very, very working-class blue-collar, traditionally working-class blue-collar areas, you saw swings back. I think, I'm not sure that we can read fully into that. I'd love to hear David's view on it as well, but I don't think we could fully read into it to say, yes, the many of those blue-collar workers who are slowly leaving Labor over the last few elections are coming back. I think there is an element of that, but I think there are bigger macro issues at play, and that is simply that the environment that Donald Trump created has got everybody very nervous, anxious, and people looked at the alternative to the current prime minister and they said he's not up for the job. And they said, you know, we would like to show our anger and grievances and punish this current government and current political party in the Labor Party, but we don't think the alternative is all that great. And, you know, and one of the very key statistics that stuck in my mind really was around, you know, going into the election, almost a third of the electorate, 33% of people, which I believe is a historic high, had not made up their mind. And that says a lot, because a lot of people, I think, were not too sure about Labor, but certainly weren't convinced by the opposition, and they just didn't want to risk it because everyone is anxious. The macro trends, the macro environment has created an economic uncertainty that is, I think, in many of our lifetimes, unrivaled, except perhaps for 2008, 2007, 2008. But I think many people are convinced that what's around the corner and what we're heading towards is something that looks even worse. And that's obviously, you know, I'm not sure how many people in Australia were paying attention to it, but that's probably obviously supported by the fact that many people might have seen that for the first time in many, many months, the US economy in the last quarter, of which, except for 20 days, Donald Trump has been president, went into negative, so it went into contraction. So the economy, effectively put simply, kind of reduced its size by 0.3%, which is not a big number. But if there is another negative number next quarter, then they are technically in a recession. So that kind of is the backdrop that set the scene. And I think all of those factors together made people very reluctant to change the government.
Yeah, look, I think you're right, Ozan. I'll just say two quick things. Firstly, I think electors, you know, actually voted fairly rationally. I think when they looked at the choices in the campaign, you know, there was one party that went in with a lot more detail and a lot more message discipline and policy discipline. But I also think that the seeds of this are a lot earlier. The Liberal Party got a big swing against it in 2022 from women and more educated people on the fact that they were seen as being very macho and male dominated, and they were seen to be very anti-action on climate change. Peter Dutton was a very strong leader within the Liberal Party and respected and credited with having a lot of unity over the last 3 years. The problem with unity is it wasn't united in addressing either of those two issues. The nuclear policy was really a policy to put climate change, out of the picture by saying, you know, we want to do something that's low emissions, but was really about ensuring that coal and gas had another decade or so in the ecosystem, and allowed some of the climate skeptics in the party to be happy that they've got some kind of fig leaf on their nuclear policy. And, you know, the independents were mostly women that won last time. Labor has elected seven new women, possibly eight if they can get Longman. Labor had one woman in Queensland. Out of the five seats they had in Queensland, they've now got eight women, possibly nine. The coalition just risks losing a generation of women. They're very poor vote share under the age of 40. This was the first election where the majority of people voting were under 40. The coalition does very well among the over 60s. They just weren't speaking to the, you know, regardless of how they actually ran the campaign, which I think is very poor, they actually didn't have a strategy that dealt with the electorate as it was, not the electorate that they wanted it to be. And in an era of, anxiety and economic stress, sure, it's logical to consider that people might vote for change, but what was the change they were voting for? Labor kept coming back to them with very positive messages that resonated. And there was a big third party campaign that I was involved in that was, you know, really reminding Australian workers that, you know, wages had gone up under this government and that their working conditions were at threat. And work from home is very popular for office-based workers. It is seen as a cost of living benefit because people get a couple of days out of, you know, commuting time and cost. You know, people, you know, can spend a bit less on childcare or, you know, eating out in the city rather than making lunch at home. Very popular with women, but also with men. You know, the Liberals didn't speak to that. They had a big backflip on work from home when it was seen for the first week and a half that they weren't in support of it. Lots of issues around that, but it was actually, you know, remarkably rational result. People were actually voting in their own economic interests this time.
Rodney, the parallels between Australia and Canada a week out of, you know, from in terms of the election dates from each other, two Commonwealth countries, very similar results, very similar swings to the small L Liberal parties, to the centre left parties, both, you know, conservative leaders losing their seats in the election. It was the same question I asked you on last week's podcast, but did Donald Trump make Australia small L Liberal again?
Look, I think that, and no doubt we'll come on to discuss Singapore, and maybe there's a bit of it in relation to Singapore too. And in certain times, as much as there's the ground campaign and what the Liberals did and didn't do, the fact that, you know, they didn't speak to the under 40s demographic, or, you know, other things that they flipped on in terms of, you know, policy, and they didn't have a great campaign. You know, there's still this overarching theme of, in uncertain times, you go to what's safe and what you trust, and often that is incumbency. I think, you know, the swing in Canada was so dramatic that it doesn't feel as if it was the key factor in Australia, where the swing, you know, had maybe not as dramatic. Maybe there are other things at play and so on. The big thing for me was, what did the people of Larimer vote? And I think they stuck Labour again. So that's quite good to see that progress in the Northern Territories. My favourite TV show, Last Stop Larimer, I'm sure you've probably seen it. But that was one of the key things for me during this election.
I don't think Australians watch Australian-made television shows, though, mate. That's the only problem with that. Is
what way that small grouping would go. So yeah, that I quite like that. You know, you have to have a favorite ward or constituency or area to go, I wonder how they're getting on with this election. So for me, it was Larimer.
I think they were all too drunk, mate. I think they were all too drunk to vote.
Low turnout, record low turnout.
Yeah.
A couple of other elections we want to get to, but Dave, I just want to get your thoughts on where the coalition, the opposition now goes, because at the time that we are recording this, there's about up to 15 seats still remaining, still to be called. We could see Labor pass the 90-seat mark, which is obviously much more than the 76 they needed to govern. The coalition, the opposition, is at just under 40 right now. It could stay there by the looks of things. That is effectively a wipeout by Australian standards. It could be that the Labor Party has almost guaranteed the next election as well. Where does the opposition now go, both in terms of the leader that it needs to obviously immediately elect, and good luck to anyone in that job. Obviously, that's a very, very tough job. But what does it need to change? You've already mentioned some of the issues around climate change and women, but are there bigger questions around the identity for the Big L Liberal Party? And what do you think are some of the discussions that are likely to be held in the sort of, you know, near to mid future?
Look, it's a good point. I must say the Liberals are doing better on postal votes. Certainly there's a possibility for Labor to get above 90, but some of the seats, particularly some of the two of them held by Teals in Victoria, could well go back to the Liberal Party. They spent well over $1 million in each of those seats. So they certainly worked hard, and there was a lot of volunteers. So there was energy there. They might pull a little bit of this back. But more generally, they've got a significant problem. John Howard, famously and often referred to the Liberal Party as a broad church, with the liberal kind of moderate strand community and a more conservative community, and essentially they worked hand in glove in his view. Now, he was a conservative, and a lot of people really say the Liberal Party's problems now are actually the result of actions in the Howard government. John Howard worked very hard to make sure that older Australians did well in terms of assets. The housing crisis is arguably made worse by decisions of the Howard and Costello government around capital gains tax concession and its impact alongside negative gearing. So the Liberal Party actually did very well to create a generation, as Ozan said, of these battlers into Liberal Party people, and tried to take away, the focus on class and unionism and focus on aspiration. He did very well for, a generation and a half. But what we're starting to see now is the Liberal Party really, losing that coalition between the Conservatives and the Liberals. Lots of these teal independent seats are run by people who really should be moderate Liberals and look like moderate Liberals, frankly. But they are not in the Liberal Party, and I'm not sure those seats in the main, obviously a couple of exceptions perhaps in Victoria, but in the main, I can't see them going back to the Liberals. And the Conservatives, some of them are very muscular, very ideological, want a MAGA-style politics, do play footsies with far-right parties in Australia, look to the US and look to that kind of, muscular nationalism. They really turn off people. And in an environment where we don't have the media that everyone watches every day at the same time, it's very easy, and it's happened, for people like Matt Canavan or Alex Antic to go on a podcast and say something that provides a lot of red meat to the base, and that gets weaponized by the Labor Party to tell moderate voters this is who the Liberal Party really is. So they've got a big decision to make about whether they can reunite these two parts of their party and keep them together, or really, do they become a Conservative Party and, the teal independents, perhaps turn into a moderate Liberal Party? Australia is used to two major parties, although in reality, the Liberals only govern with the Nationals. They've been in coalition for a long time. But they're the difficulties that a new leader is going to have to face. Do we try and just poke holes in Labor, which is always possible, and find a way to kind of, win each election? But structurally, I think they've got a bigger issue, and it's very difficult for them, and will be very difficult for them to work through.
I know this has all been about Australia, and we've gone on for quite a while, but I think one last point that we need to make is, there's also a question around the Greens. The Greens have lost significant amounts of ground. David, if I'm not mistaken, they've lost three of the four seats that they had in Queensland.
They've definitely lost two out of the three they had. Well lose the third. But Griffith and Brisbane are definitely gone. Ryan was a Liberal seat, and the Liberal vote, has held up a little bit. But it's still in doubt.
And also, I think their leader, Adam Bandt, may still win in Melbourne, but certainly struggled. I think the overall theme here is, you know, people went, okay, I'm looking at someone to govern. And, you know, in the Greens have done great on protest issues. And, you know, many of these teals, like, they've done well when there's been grievance and enough people saying, okay, I can risk it and send a message and a protest, etc. But I think one of the reasons for why the Greens have tanked is probably because people have said, okay, I may not like everything that Labor's doing, because traditionally many Green voters used to be Labor voters, but maybe they've turned back and said, okay, I need someone to govern in these uncertain times. But also the other question is, if Adam Bandt does lose his seat in the seat of Melbourne, then who replaces him and what's the future for the Greens?
It's a big issue. The Greens have... not had a large swing against them, and they will hold pretty much all of their Senate seats. They're likely to hold. So in the lower house, it's been a bigger problem. But you're right, you know, in change elections, and there was certainly a lot of energy around, you know, could the Liberals win this election? Could the coalition win? You know, I think Labor and others were very focused at reminding people that, you know, a vote for the Greens is a vote for potentially instability in the parliament. And I think a lot of Green voters, who, you know, some of which were former Labor voters anyway, came back. And it is a problem for the Greens. The Greens also have a very complicated constituency from, you know, environmentalists who are often older and wealthier, and very socially progressive, you know, often anti-capitalists who are younger, who are very focused and exercised by issues like the war in Gaza. So it's very different constituencies they have to stitch together. And arguably that's had an impact this time.
Well, as the Labor Party in Australia celebrates, it's... the Labor Party in the UK, not so much after some other elections took place there in the UK. Rodney, tell us why Labor isn't happy there.
Yeah, they had a bad election. I think that's probably why they're unhappy. So do the Conservatives. But the Conservatives previously, in this batch of local government seats that were up for re-election, the Conservatives had a particularly good election last time round. So they were going to lose seats, but possibly not as catastrophically as they did. You know, for being the opposition party, and maybe they'll say it's too early after the election for them to receive the protest vote. But, you know, the Conservatives went down from 980-odd seats or close to 1,000 seats, maybe 990, down to about 300. That's significant loss of 600-plus seats, maybe 650, 670. And Reform gained 670. Labour, who were on a poor election result the last time round on just under 300, lost nearly 200 seats, down to less than 100 in this particular set of non-urban local elections. And the real winners were obviously Reform, the Liberal Democrats and the Greens. Now, you could say, well, this is fine. It's hot button issues for the usual protest parties, and they tend to yo-yo, and had it been a national election, perhaps we would have seen something more like the picture in Australia and Canada, where in uncertain times people would have gone for safety, what they trust, etc., and experience. But what this has created for Reform, who were sitting with six MPs or five, and I think maybe six because of the Runcorn by-election, which they won by six votes in the end after a recount, it gives them 600 to 700 active people on the ground in areas where they are going to be wanting to contest parliamentary seats. Just as Reform had into the Conservative vote, which created some space for Labour to get this plus 400 seats in Westminster, and they're now eating into the Conservative vote at the general election. Now they're eating into the Labour vote too, in northern cities and northern constituencies. And, you know, the immigration's the issue. It was the reason why a large number of Reform voters voted Reform. I think maybe a third said it was a top issue, and for over 80%, it was a top three issue. It's the same issue that Reform tapped into deliver the Brexit referendum result through its previous incarnation of UKIP. But they never had this large number of councillors that they have now to really build a platform on. And there will be loads of crazies elected, we know that, and there'll be loads of media stories about what someone posted on social media and so on. But the bloc's so big, there's a resourcing benefit to this whole thing. And I expect that it's a great platform for reform to continue to push. And unless the Conservatives and Labour address the issue of immigration, reform's here to stay in the UK. I know that, you know, people are wildly predicting Farage might be the next Prime Minister and so on. I don't think we're at that level of danger yet. But we are seeing something more than just a you know, single election outing where people are protesting in a particular way. You know, people have voted for Nigel Farage or his candidates at successive elections, and at some point your protest vote, if it's repeatedly placed in the same against the same party on the ballot paper, it becomes something more permanent, and it's a lot harder to switch back. I think Labour are in a better position than the Conservatives as a result of this bad election for both, but they just can't be complacent. They can't dismiss this as something that'll blow over. They need to really look into the motivation of voters who did depart Labour and arrive at the Reform Party's door during these local elections.
So local elections usually don't attract this much attention, but David, any sort of macro learnings you think from the weekend's results there?
Well, I think people like us and listeners to your podcast get excited about every election. So
yeah, exactly.
I'm certainly spent some time looking at this, even though I was very focused on Australia. Look, I mean, I think for people who look for sensible, sober, political discourse, parties like Reform do create a chill. And certainly there will be people in the UK and beyond who will be looking at this in terms of, you know, essentially whether we're seeing a trend of these sorts of nativist, muscly right-wing parties. It's not great to see them have such a strong result in the UK. I guess I will just say that my read on this is a little moderated, and I think Rodney did, you know, say much of this. This is not a national election. It was not even an election in the big cities like London or Manchester or Birmingham. Some of these regional electorates are electorates where you would expect Reform to be strong when essentially the Tories are pretty weak with a new leader. Labour has not had a fabulous start to its term either. And so, you know, this is kind of a prime time in and prime locations for a bit of a protest vote. The risk for Reform is that it's much easier to argue about what's going wrong than it is to fix it. A lot of these local authorities have very little power and very little money. You know, when electors go to the next national election, I should say, it'll be 4 years to go, there'll be a lot that Labor will have done, hopefully, and the Tories will also have, restored potentially some of their, prestige and approach. So it is quite possible that while this isn't a great result, and it's not a result I would have liked to have seen, certainly if I was in the UK, I do think that this speaks to a big drop off from where the Tories were 4 years ago, when arguably Boris Johnson was at his peak. These are in, you know, areas that Reform do well. And I think, you know, Izad and I were saying earlier, you know, sometimes the experience of watching some of these minor parties actually take the levers of power makes people wonder why they gave them that choice. And I suspect there are millions of people in the US who may, you know, perhaps not the MAGA base, obviously, but millions of others who might be looking at Trump in the same way. We gave somebody an opportunity and look what they've done. Let's see what these Reform people do in local government in the UK. It might be an absolute disaster and they never do as well again.
I think I'm going to take the fence on this one because I agree with both Rodney and David and see both sides of it. But I think it is a very significant result for Reform. And yes, it is rural. I completely agree with David. These are small councils, etc. But I mean, if the sentiment is that strong for reform in those places, one has to wonder how long it will take before, it is seen in some of those more outer suburbs and other places near the big cities. And I mean, it sends some dangerous signals and messages that, let's say, it is very not representative of the whole country and not representative of the cities. But if there's such a big divide and such a bad result for Labor, this is politically, if you ask me, some of those alarm bells should be ringing. But at the same time, I agree. I think give them a chance and let's watch. I think you'll find that most of these people will just prove to everyone through their behaviour what clowns they are. So I think let them have a chance.
Look, nobody, yes and no, nobody voted for them because of their competence in local government. They voted for them because they're angry about immigration. And unless the government address that, they're going to be angry about immigration in 4 years' time or 2 years' time, whenever the next opportunity to vote is. And they'll not blame reform for failing to deal with immigration because they'll not be a party elected to a position where they could have done so. So I'm afraid I think there's a danger attached to this in terms of a lurch to the right. And yes, it isn't a national election, but the underlying sentiment political parties can't ignore. They have to think through what they're going to do in terms of their own policy platform to address these concerns. And it's easier for the Conservatives to do that than Labour.
And also, it gives them an organising base, as you pointed out, Rodney. I mean, and we've all been involved in politics. That when you do have that organising base, half of the game is basically doing the work on the ground. And if you've got the resources through councillors, etc., who are now dedicated to put the reform former UKIP message out there, then obviously that elevates them. It's just whether they, behave in a way that kind of preserves their brand. Well, also the question needs to be, what is their brand? I suppose not too many people take them all that seriously. So let's say
you make a good point, Ozan. I mean, one of the things I would almost be more concerned about is the fact that they've now got substantially more members than the Tories and the Labour Party. There's been a big effort and expense into getting members. I didn't mean any of my comments to say, it's all okay, don't worry about reform. To me, this is a warning for both of the major parties. Essentially, this is the Tories' loss more than it is Labour's. It will get painted as Labour's problem because they're in power nationally. But, this was off a high from Boris Johnson. And yes, the Tories have to sort themselves out. There are people in the Tory party who want to do deals with, reform, want to bring them into the tent, swap, they can't swap preferences, not preferential voting, but, certainly sort of have agreements on where to campaign and not. This would be very dangerous. There's a lot at risk with reform having more profile. Hopefully, the lived experience of them, likely to have had some very inexperienced and unusual people, vetting that many candidates in that many regional locations, who knows what some of them will turn out to be. Hopefully that will be the saviour, but it's certainly a risk.
Just remember, before we, when UKIP, prior to the referendum on Brexit, UKIP, had their local government surge, but, they were into a couple of hundred councillors, not 600 to 700. This is much more significant in terms of even numbers and again, resourcing on the ground, right? Sorry about that. Just forgot to mention that earlier.
Yeah.
No problem at all. Speaking of numbers and percentage increases, there was another percentage increase in the People's Action Party in Singapore after the election there on Saturday saw the PAP's popular vote rise to above 65%. Ozan, what can you tell us about the Singaporean elections?
Well, I mean, we discussed last time, there wasn't a massive expectation of a lot of seats changing hands or parties. However, it seems that both of the major parties really maintain their strength. So the PAP, as you said, the People's Action Party, have maintained the number of seats they won as per the last election. And in a lot of the areas, they've increased their percentage vote. And the Workers' Party, who are the main opposition, also ended up winning the same number of seats in the same places. And they've also marginally, if not held their strength, marginally increased in some of those areas. So it looks like they'll have 12 seats with two additional being given as non-constituent members. So I think that's an interesting thing. A lot of the has come at the expense of some of the other opposition parties. And there's been some very good post-election analysis by Black Box, David Black at Black Box. I'd encourage people to read it, and you know, he's done quite a lot of polling pre the election, but as per the laws in Singapore, a lot of that polling is not allowed to be announced or published until after the election. So, you know, in his polling, he's very clearly indicated that the PAP was perceived to be very strong, which is good news for Prime Minister Lawrence Wong. This was a big test for him. He had taken over and really was, there was some, I think, anxiety about how it might be perceived if the PAP didn't do as well as they did on Saturday. But he certainly answered a lot of those questions. And I think he's cemented his leadership in the party. And, you know, I think what he's done in the last 12 months is prepare for this election through very, very diligent and quite a lot of hard work. And some of our listeners may have heard his now viral message on TikTok in response to the Trump tariffs and some of the economic uncertainty around that. And, you know, he was perceived, according to the polls, as a very strong leader, somebody that gave confidence to people to steer Singapore through what are very rough and choppy waters. And I think that's the same could be said, I think, for the Workers' Party as well, and their leadership and what they've done. The voters gave that a big approval, big vote of confidence in the way that they've behaved as the opposition. So I think numbers-wise, not much has changed, but I think it's very clear that Singaporeans, and there may be some people might argue that there's some correlation between what happened in Australia around, you know, people not taking risks, etc. Some of that may have played, and people may have thought, okay, you know, we're going to vote for a steady government, safe pair of hands to steer us through these tough times.
And Rodney, to bring us home, you've had your eye on another election, which is in Romania.
Yeah, you know, this is my little interest one from back last year, when the guy that nobody had heard of suddenly took a massive number of votes, and it was challenged in the Constitutional Court, and then Calin Georgescu was duly prohibited from participating in the rerun. He had been accused of being pro-Putin, Russian interference. He suddenly had all these accounts appear on social media overnight, you know, celebrating his life and contribution to, I don't know, Romania. And there was this, there was just a lot of questions, such that the Constitutional Court intervened, unprecedented, removed his candidature, said it had to be run again, and it was run again. And this time, George Simeon is the replacement candidate on the right, but he secured 41% of the vote. And then the two other centrist candidates got 21% each. So one of them, who I believe is now going to be Dan, who's going to be involved in the runoff. He will have to, or they will have to, they'll have to absorb all the other centre votes in order to get ahead of Simeon, and there is a fair chance that he will win. He's not classic where the Eastern Europe right are at the moment, because he seems to be pro-NATO, pro-Trump, but anti-Putin, and anti-EU, or at least Eurosceptic. So it's a bit of a mixed bag in terms of where he sits on the right, and possibly that's a deliberate position in that he doesn't, push himself so far that that he loses some votes from that base on either the NATO or the Russia issue. So it may well be very much planned to split around those issues, but it's going to be a very interesting runoff. And from a European perspective, this sort of move to the right from Eastern Europe is something which is of concern, in particular because of the Russia-Ukraine situation. So yeah, it's one to watch, and there'll be there'll be a lot of people within the European establishment who've been criticised by Simeon, hoping that he isn't the winner in the final voting round.
Well, David Imber, thank you so much for joining us this week and contributing your views to all these elections that apparently happened over the weekend, but particularly for putting what happened in Australia very simply for us. Appreciate your time.
Not a problem. Thank you very much.
And Rodney and Ozan, always good to speak to you this week. See you next.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroka Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch. Thanks for listening.